we face in one another ministry. And these are not exhaustive. And as after I mention these again, I'll kind of ask you all, what do you see as well in terms of additional things? But I'm thinking both things that come from within us, right? Unique temptations, and then also pressures that come at us from the outside. So I'm going to talk about two of each, because I think this will help us understand why spiritual erosion can happen in the first place. And this first one is that we can traffic in truth without being impacted ourselves. Right, that we can have a lively ministry, but it doesn't necessarily, in and of itself, equate to a vital relationship with the Lord. Just because we're handling holy things doesn't mean that we ourselves are becoming holy. Right, you see that all throughout, particularly the Old Testament. Right, the priests and the prophets and the kings who are unworthy shepherds. They had a form, right? They were a form of godliness, but it was not backed up by their lives. And sometimes there wasn't even a form of godliness, as there was rank idolatry. Just because we have this incredible privilege of stewarding, you know, to use Paul's term, stewarding the mysteries of God, doesn't necessarily mean that is impacting our hearts. We can study for information rather than seeking transformation from the Spirit in our lives. So we can traffic in truth. We can study. And it almost be a vicarious kind of experience, right? Where we're maybe prepping for some, you know, teaching or preaching or Sunday school or something like that, and it's for someone else. But our own heart isn't moved in that process. So we're preparing it for someone else. Maybe you've heard the phrase "never trust a skinny cook." What does that mean? You know, basically, if you're preparing something that is this wonderful feast, you want to sample it. You want to eat it yourself. So if you're the person who's preparing the meal is like, "Oh, I don't want to touch that," you're going to be less likely to want to touch it. So if we have this privilege, in a sense, of bringing the gospel to bear on people's lives, we want to partake of that. We want to be cooks who are, you know, vitally partaking of what we're giving others. It's very much what Jeremiah says in Jeremiah 15:16. "When your words came, I ate them. They were my joy and my heart's delight, for I bear your name, O Lord God Almighty." Would that be our prayer? That we're not simply a conduit, you know, almost like a pipe through which, you know, the truths of the gospel pass through us, but more like a reservoir that is overflowing with the goodness of the gospel in the multifaceted ways that it impacts our lives and the lives of those we minister to. So that's one, I think, temptation that we face, that we can be handling truth, but it not actually impact our heart. And it's easy to, and again, it's one of these things where erosion can take place. You know, just think about your times in the Word over the last, you know, over the last 2 weeks. Have they been vital? Have they been heart warming? Okay, we can be, again, handling holy things, but not being impacted. Secondly, I think particularly in as leaders in ministry, we can struggle to admit our need. We can struggle to admit weakness. There can be a temptation to give the appearance that everything is okay. And of course, I'm not thinking that we live our lives as open books before every single person, and every single person knows everything about us. I'm certainly not saying that. There is wisdom, right, in terms of how what we share with others and for what reason. But I think in general, this is right, our culture, that it is shameful to be weak. It is shameful to not be a pillar of strength. And I think that carries over oftentimes into our church culture as well. Now, that would not be our confessional theology. Our confessional theology is a theology of the cross. Our confessional theology is 1 Corinthians 1:18 through 2:5, which talks about the foolishness of the cross and the weakness of the cross and how God uses that to overturn the powers. That's our confessional theology, but our functional theology is, I got to be strong. I got to have it together. Think about the way that we, you know, will most commonly answer the question, how are you doing? Fine. You know, like we might, again, depending on the person, we might elaborate on that. But one of my mentors and friends, and some of you know, Joe Novenson, pastor at Lookout Mountain, he says, I think it's okay to say fine to that as long as you make it an acronym, you know. Fine means frustrated, insecure, neurotic, and exhausted, all right? So, how are you? Fine. Oh, yeah, me too. Yeah, you know, so, but generally, we're not communicating that when we say we're fine. I had a counselee who was, I think, really insightful about these things. She distinguished between being open and being vulnerable, and she put herself in the first category. She said people would really see me. My friends would see me as a very honest person, a very open person. But she was careful in terms of what she would communicate. So she would be open about a struggle, but with that kind of came this communication, but I'm okay now, or I'm handling this okay on my own. I just wanted you to know that I'm struggling with this, but I'm okay. I'm handling this on my own. Versus vulnerability, which says, I'm really struggling right now, and I need your help, right? That's the difference between openness and vulnerability. Paul talks about that, I think, in a lot of places in his letters. He's vulnerable, probably no more so than in 2 Corinthians throughout the book. But at the very beginning, in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, starting in verse 8, he says, "We do not want you to be unaware, brothers, of the affliction we experienced in Asia. We were so utterly burdened beyond our strength that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death. But that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead. He delivered us from such a deadly peril, and He will deliver us. On Him we have set our hope that He will deliver us again." Now, if you just stop there, you'd say, okay, well, he's being open. He's not really being that vulnerable, right? He's saying, this is what it was, and everything's okay now. But then he says in verse 11, "You also must help us by prayer, so that many will give thanks on our behalf for the blessing granted us through the prayers of many." So there's this expression of, you guys got to be with me in this. I need your help. And the best way, obviously, for the Corinthians to be helpful to Paul is by praying for him. I think one last thing to say here in terms of this struggle to admit weakness or need. Been really helped by Zach Eswine's writings. He's a PCA pastor. I think he teaches at Covenant right now. I don't know if he's head of homiletics, but he's a professor there. And he in and I noted two of his books at the end uh, of of the handout. But he basically says, ever since the fall, we have been tempted to be everywhere for all. Okay, so kind of grasping at omnipresence. We have been tempted to be a fix-it-all, right? Grasping at omnipotence and a know-it-all. We're tempted to be a know-it-all, excuse me, which is grasping at omniscience. And to the extent that we are that we're being tempted in that way, I have to be everywhere for everyone. I have to be able to fix this problem. I gotta amass resources so that I can answer these, you know, these perplexing and whether they're questions that are related to your congregation itself or broader cultural questions. I gotta know it all. There is this this sense of not being able to exist under that weight. And that's right, because we were not meant to be omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. So I highly recommend his books. I think too often we have a functional theology of ministry that has infinite capacity as part of its job description. But as ministers of the gospel, we are weak. We are needy. We are finite. Right? I mean, putting it the most blunt way I can, why is it shameful to be a mere human being in ministry? But we feel that. We feel the inadequacy of that. Okay? So those are two internal temptations. Other things that come to mind for you in terms of things that that are driving potentially you internally that move you away from places of spiritual vitality. Other things that that come to mind there in terms of the internal, you know, what are the things that your heart desires or fears that could move you in unhealthy directions?
Mike, this issue of openness versus vulnerability is really impactful, but it's tricky in my mind. I help to oversee a recovery group, and if you don't have openness and vulnerability, you're not going to have any kind of success or persistency in people recovering from any kind of addiction. Leadership capacity, the ability to be vulnerable can sometimes be hard because you don't want to discourage someone who might be earlier on in their recovery.
Yep.
So openness is really easy. The vulnerability and the wisdom to display that can become a little bit more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to speak to that, but that can also be sort of the kind of clutch that Don was talking about. I can't go there because when you really ought to. I don't have the tools. I can't help.
Yeah. So there's a wisdom in self-disclosure, and I think in some ways that so it's not always right an issue of that it's about me and my own fears that keep me from admitting weakness, right? Sometimes, right, is this helpful for this person? Like, another side issue really is anytime that we are self-disclosing, it should be an act of love, right? It should be a beneficial for the other person. So that does factor in, right, to some of the burden there in terms of why leadership can often be such a lonely and isolating place. Because sometimes will say, I don't know that this would be wise to disclose. This is something that I feel like I need to steward myself, or with maybe, you know, one or two other people that are very, very close to me. But there is a certain isolation that comes with that. What else? Other thoughts?
So I'm with my brother here on here doing his Bible study on Nehemiah, who is approaching the king. Mm. He's asking the king to rebuild the wall. And I think the words were kind of like, as I was approaching, I'm praying. You know, and that whole sense that even my next words, God will instruct and have a sense of what is timing, the way Jim was asking, you know, wisdom of self-disclosure, discretion. Mm-hmm. Like this spiritual realm of living in that is quite fascinating. And the way he wasn't praying all morning, he was also praying on the way to deliver the message.
Yep.
In the sense that we're encouraged to pray on all occasions for all ways, you know, for all things. And I think, God help me. You know, may I know what to do there? Because, you know, age does bring some wisdom, but it also brings other things.
Mm-hmm.
Bias.
Mm-hmm. Jadedness, cynicism, you know, many of the things that we see.
So yeah, I mean, it's a two-edged sword.
Yeah, and you're also highlighting that how these, you know, things play off each other. If we're basically in this mindset that's very kind of self-oriented, I've got to get this done, I've got to do this, this will be less likely, you know, that we're doing this, and then it'll be really harder to discern, like, when is it a good thing that I'm, you know, that I'm vulnerable. So I think that's, they play off of each other.
How about the difference between the value I receive from perceived identity versus the value I experience from real identity or being in Christ?
Yeah.
I know Cap and I still have this thing. I don't know where I got it. It might have been from our church here, but it's an identity card. I am, and it lists, you know, all the words that the scripture is rich in our standing in Christ, who we are, and the value we have. But candidly, I find myself gravitating towards, oh, Don, you're doing such a great job.
Yeah.
Or, boy, you're good at that. Or, well, you seem to be omniscient. You seem to be omnipresent.
And, yep.
It drives you. It deceives you. And can I say one more thing? Because it goes way back to, I was very immature in faith when I first went to seminary. And I thought this was going to be a tremendous breeding ground for devotional depth. And I worked hard, and I got good grades, but it hit me. I wasn't learning very much English Bible at all. The understanding was you would be walking in faith with Christ devotionally, and I would learn theology and church history and homiletics.
Yep.
But I had no working capital.
Yeah,
and it just blew me apart.
Yeah, yeah. That's you're touching on a number of different things. You're touching on that issue of, in a sense, handling the scriptures and being engaged in prayer, but actually it not nourishing your own soul. And so that's one aspect. And then this very important aspect as well, in terms of drawing our identity, our sense of well-being from any place, really, other than Christ. But as those of us who are engaged in one another ministry, you know, who am I if I'm not, you know, a good teacher, a good preacher, a good discipler, a great, you know, small group leader, et cetera, et cetera. So where is our ultimate identity? So that would be another temptation that we face in ministry, to draw our identity and our sense of well-being from the work that we're doing there.
Something goes along with that too, is drawing our identity from what other people think.
Mm-hmm.
As well. So I don't want to be seen as a non-responsive minister.
Yeah.
I don't want people to see me as not responsive to their needs.
Yeah.
Have a positive affirmation that people in ministry can get from others.
Right.
Instead of our accusations.
That's right. We'll talk. I think some of this, when we talk about busyness, I'll touch on that as well. Like some of our chosen busyness relates to that, right? Like my inability to say no can relate directly, not always, but can relate directly to what will other people think if I say no. Yes.
When I'm having a moment of sanity, I look at these three O's: omnipotence, omnipresence, and omniscience. Those are reserved only for God. But you know, the truth is, I want to be God.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have to remind myself all the time that I'm not God.
Yeah.
And if I do that, then I'm going to have my head on boom straight.
Yep. I mean, think about it. That's really from the fall, right? We can be, there's the lie, there's the original lie, we can be like God. And it doesn't work, right? We are creatures, not the creator. So when we're seeking to be any of those three categories, it's right and appropriate that we feel the impossibility of that. And that impossibility then, rather than leading us to despair or to ratchet up our efforts, you can either give up or gear up, in those kind of situations. Do we, in a sense, give up, right, and go to the Lord? Let me move to some of the external pressures that we face in ministry. And again, I'll just highlight two, not that these are the exhaustive, but one is this relentless exposure to evil and suffering that we experience in ministry. We certainly hear good stories. We certainly see places where the Lord is at work. But oftentimes, the work of ministry there's a front line stance on difficult things, and so there's a true spiritual, emotional, and physical fatigue that comes from ministering to hurting people. So it's inevitable. It's inevitable that we will be impacted by the stories of those that we're ministering to. And I would say, if we're not impacted, that's probably a warning sign, right? That we've put too much distance, or we've put on too much of a self-protective shell that we're not being moved by people's sufferings. I have a quote here from Diane Langberg. Now, she's speaking in the context, she's talking to other counselors, but I think it has a lot of overlap with our work in One Another Ministry. And she says this: they bring you their stories. Now, generally, it's not going to be a perfect stranger, right? Because in a community, we know one another. But sometimes it is, right? Sometimes it may be a newcomer. A perfect stranger walks into your room with a story unknown to you. They will take you to places you've never been and perhaps do not want to go. They will force you to be present to abuse, violence, death, deceit, brokenness, and darkness. You sit surrounded by all of this stuff day after day, hour after hour, and you are an image bearer. You will be impacted or shaped. Make no mistake, the work of therapy, or I would say, or ministry, means sitting with evil and suffering. To think otherwise is to be deceived. And so she asks the question, what am I to do so that I do not end up in the very shape of that death and darkness? Wow, what a potent quote and a potent, in a sense, prophetic word to us. Yes, how do we not end up into that very shape of death and darkness? How do we not experience the kind of erosion that we've been talking about? And my hope is we will answer that question as we go throughout this day. But it's a reality in ministry. And Paul talks about it as well, right? In 2 Corinthians 11:28, apart from other things, there is the daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. So Paul's very realistic about this, that that ministry is taxing. Ministry is wearing. It can be hard to see, you know, where is Jesus? What is he up to? Is the kingdom advancing? All I'm experiencing right now is darkness. Where is the light? Okay, so relentless exposure to evil and suffering. So how we'll talk hard, I think, or we'll talk about how we lean hard against that when we talk about practices that. The deep in our walk with Christ. And then I think another external pressure is that of increased spiritual warfare. When we're in ministry, there is a target on our back. Peter talks about this at the end of 1 Peter, in 1 Peter 5. 1 Peter 5:8 says, "Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour." In the whole context of that discussion, he's talking to elders. He's talking to shepherds in the church, and he's warning them of the work of Satan. I've been studying First Thessalonians, and one of the things that struck me, I'm at the end of chapter 2 now. Well, that's the second set of Thessalonians. Okay, here we go. Paul says, he's talking about how he wanted to come and see the Thessalonians. He had a very short ministry in Thessalonica, was driven out by persecution. He was wondering, how are they doing? Was finally able to send Timothy. Timothy comes back with this great report. They're doing well. And so that prompts this letter to the Thessalonians. And at the end of chapter 2, Paul says, since we were torn away from you, brothers, for a short time, in person, not in heart, we endeavored the more eagerly and with great desire to see you face to face, because we wanted to come to you. I, Paul, again and again, but Satan hindered us. I mean, he could have said a lot of things, but it wasn't God's timing, or who knows what he could have said, but he highlighted the work of Satan here. So, Satan hinders. Satan attacks. Satan is the liar, the murderer, the cheater. John Newton, obviously very seasoned pastor, knew that in his letter writing. He has a lot of letters to young ministers, and one of them is on the snares and difficulties attending the ministry of the gospel. Just listen to this, what he says here. "You've known something of Satan's devices while you were in private life, but you may now expect to hear from him and to be beset by his power and subtlety in a different manner. You are now to be placed in the forefront of the battle and to stand, as it were, as his main target. So far as he can prevail against you now, not yourself only, but many others will be affected. The work of ministry is truly honorable, but like the post of honor in a battle, it is attended with peculiar dangers." I don't know about you, but that's not at the forefront of my mind when I get up in the morning. It's sort of like, okay, gotta walk the dog, gotta get a shower, I'm not thinking in categories of spiritual warfare, okay? But this is critical for us in ministry to realize that we have the forces of evil, you know, assailing us, so that it's not this person who's principally my enemy. We have an enemy who's sowing the seeds of conflict that are making me say, this person, you know, I don't want to spend any time with them, right? Do we frame our struggles in that kind of way? So, again, I think an urging for us to say, this is a true pressure. We do spend a lot of time talking about the world and the flesh, but we don't spend a lot of time, you know, talking about the devil. And yet, that is a true tripartite enemy, in a sense, that we face. I'll just mention it briefly now, because we'll cover it more separately later, but busyness, I would say that actually straddles both these categories. So there's an internal, we have particular reasons internally, hearts, desires and fears that move us toward busyness, and then there are also external pressures and forces that bring busyness into our life. So I want to treat that separately, but I think that also falls into, whether it's unique, I don't know, but we certainly experience it, I think, a lot in ministry. We'll take a break here in just a couple minutes because we're at a juncture to move into this next section. But comments, questions in terms of this, what we've covered here, these reasons why we're pressed and why we might experience spiritual erosion in our lives. Thoughts?
Talking about, we are not omniscient, we are not omnipresent, we are not all the things that God is. I think sometimes it's hard to know, okay, you can recognize that and say, I'm not God here, but knowing that next step when you're dealing with people fine china is the hard part, not being able to, I might not be the person to help you or not be able to do that, but who could I connect you with? And sometimes it's hard when all the other people you connect them with are also feeling the same way.
Yeah.
So it's just something I had that thought as you were talking. Lord, that's where we really need wisdom. And maybe we'll get into that later, but that's the hardest part, I feel like, is to drop something.
Yep.
Is not just to drop a task. It's actually to drop someone's life.
Right.
So it just feels weightier.
It does feel weighty. So you're right. So we may not, it's not like we may be desiring in that moment to be God. In fact, someone else may be desiring us to be omniscient, omnipresent, and that's really hard, particularly if the resources are really thin in terms of where else, where else can I connect this person to? So I think we'll talk about some of those challenges when we talk about busyness, but I definitely want to get into some of those weeds.
Another area, I don't know if this is kind of the area we talk about, is the experience of, as you age, of pouring out your life over and over and over. And sometimes being hurt, you come upon somebody else, similar situation, not going there again, like those kind of things. I don't know if anybody brought that out in any of the kind of things that trip us up as we approach ministry.
Yeah. So experiencing experiencing particular suffering, conflict, misunderstanding, you could put the whole, that then, in a sense, sensitizes us to not wanting to enter into that again. We've been burned once. We do not want to be burned again. Or we've been burned 20 times. And it's like, I'm not going to do the 21st, right? Yeah.
There's the, the sense of my limitations, but then I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And so it's really, that even makes me feel, maybe I should be doing more.
Yeah.
Maybe I should do more. What does it mean that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me? What does it mean that His energy works in me? It can be confusing.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, so Philippians 4, 13, Philippians 2, I think it's 12 and 13. This is part, and this is part of some of the paradoxes that we have to deal with, right? Like, we are, when we are weak, we are strong. Wait a minute, weakness is portrayed as a good thing in Scripture, yet our experience of weakness is often not, you know, not that. What does it mean that that we rely on Christ's strength? We'll talk a little bit more about that, I think, in, when we talk about busyness in terms of when is it appropriate to say, I can't, and I need, there's some change in my situation that has to happen here. That doesn't undo, you know, Philippians 4:13, or doesn't undo the working out of our salvation.
Russell, for me, the motive, I have to wrestle with motive of my thought. For instance, mm-hmm. when someone says to me, if not you, then who? Mm-hmm. Is it my pride that's going to make me come up with that answer, or is it my confidence in the gospel promise, I can do all things? You know, am I leaning on him, or am I really wanting to be fed in my arrogance?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's the motives matter, right? And this is, I think this is also one of the reasons why Sally Canning doesn't particularly like that term self-care, because there is this sense that I'm not living into that paradox. Like I might feel like I have nothing in the tank, and yet there also may be, as I prayerfully consider it, Lord, you have to energize me here. Or it may be, here's another person that needs to be involved. But depending on what our motives are there, it could be a quick no, because out of self-preservation, or it could be, sure, because I'm drawing my identity from, you know, being in ministry, or vice, or a host of other motives. Yeah.
So the tension that I'm thinking of here is the moving into the need, but losing sight of the objective of the church. So in a sense, you know, if we stand in front of Christ, the individuals and grow appropriately. And if we stand behind Christ, then Christ takes over. If we move in and don't delegate to others and give them an opportunity to grow, then the church doesn't expand in its leadership. So these tensions mm-hmm. exist. But I do believe that we need discretion on those things, but I also believe we need a common belief. Because if there's 70 people not on the same page with that, the church doesn't, it moves back and forth too much.
Yeah.
So like that's really a big tension as the time of the church goes on.
Mm-hmm.
What do we really want for, as shepherds of the flock, for to the growth of the individual?
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to wrestle with the Lord? Are we going to put more weight on them wrestling with the Lord than us wrestling for them in the Lord? You know, if you talk to someone who's gone through a crisis, I've often heard, I would never give up what I had to go through for the sake of my relationship with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
It was his relationship with Christ that was the growth. It was not what I was standing in front of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we need to work on that.
Yeah.
As a common objective.
Yeah. I think you're highlight. You didn't quite say it this way, but there's a sense in which moving through these challenges is more than, you know, here's a written out shepherding plan. Like there's this sense in which, well, not that that's unimportant, of course, but there is this sense in which what does it mean to relinquish someone to the Lord and trust that the Lord is at work in their hearts, even if we are unable to be, you know, what they want us to be? That's a very difficult discerning process for sure. So I think you're highlighting the, first of all, the need to say, are we shepherding in the same way? Are we on board in the same way? But then just the complexities of even those mini moments, you know, where we don't want to stand in front of Christ, as you said. So Good. Let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and start talking about cultivating our spiritual lives as an antidote to this. Sorry, Warden. Yeah.